First of all, thank you all for coming out. He tells me there's a big game tonight, so I will do my best to take as long as possible and see how many of you leave early, just to see who gets to be the first. So we'll spend the first hour talking about, and I'll introduce myself in a second, the first hour looking at service-oriented architecture and best practices with BizTalk, and we'll spend the later session looking at how do I use some of the new cloud computing platforms and then still leverage BizTalk at the same time. So hopefully some interesting demonstrations. I don't know if I'd be having more things plugged into me at the moment. After the break, actually, Michael will attach me to a car battery just to see what will happen. All right, so we're going to be looking at BizTalk SOA, looking at the cloud. I am a solution architect for a biotechnology company based north of Los Angeles, back in California. I am a MVP for BizTalk. I just recently wrote a book that maybe some of you have picked up about SOA patterns with BizTalk 2009. And I try to blog quasi-regularly at my website, sirother.wordpress.com. So what are our goals for tonight? Really, I was hoping to show you or talk about four key things. It's really, is SOA still relevant? What are we talking about when we talk about SOA? When is BizTalk the right tool for service-oriented architecture? How am I supposed to use it in that way? And then really the majority of the time is, how do I build BizTalk-oriented solutions in a service-oriented way? Now, of course, because we're looking at some new paradigms out there with cloud computing, I also want to talk about how do I leverage some of these new platforms with my on-site service bus in BizTalk. So I'll show you about three demonstrations in the morning or the early session, and another four about cloud computing in the later one. So lots of demonstrations. So does SOA still matter? So, you know, maybe earlier this year you happened to read a couple of articles that were saying SOA is dead. Oh my gosh, that means we're all going to be unemployed because we rely on this. So articles all over the place, SOA is dead. People misinterpreted some of that, of what that meant. So the point of what was said out there wasn't that the pattern was wrong. It was that a lot of products are sold and a lot of consultants in some cases pitch things that were SOA is the best thing. If you just say you buy something that's SOA, congratulations, you're really agile and flexible now. And of course, no one could possibly accomplish that by just buying a product. It takes good discipline as architects. So the pattern is good. The hype was wrong. So we still want to have good design practices for abstraction, encapsulation, loose coupling, all those sorts of things. You know, it's separating your contract from your code. Again, none of this is now irrelevant just because someone wrote that SOA is dead. So what we'll also be looking at is as we look at the cloud paradigm and we look at having services hosted by the Google App Engine or services hosted by Windows Azure or something hosted in the Amazon infrastructure for cloud computing, that idea of services is exactly how this space plays, is that you're buying computing services. It's very service-oriented. So it actually is a nice extension of if you're comfortable with SOA, doing something with cloud computing is not a big transition for you, and it puts you in a good position for already understanding SOA and BizTalk. This isn't a difficult thing to grasp then. So why did the whole SOA is dead stuff really happen? Again, it was SOA being pitched as the next best thing, which is arguably where we are with cloud computing right now, is that it's pitched as the next best thing. So we're going to have this the same discussion if you know you like me and you bring me back 2 years from now, and I'll say, cloud computing is not dead, and we'll have the same conversation that it's like SOA is not dead, cloud computing won't be dead. So the problem with most people is that when you started your SOA project, you ended up trying to do all the governance, all the big stuff on the first project. And as most of you know, if you try to take one project to be successful and keep adding a bunch of other scope and big corporate things about it, it's really hard to be successful. So can you actually be successful with SOA? Yeah, if you focus on the project, you focus on applying good principles, you hopefully rely on your organization to do some of the big picture things without forcing your project to have to do them all. So just a bunch of web services is the acronym, which is the thing you can fall into, which is everybody throws out a bunch of web services, you say you're SOA, and everybody's happy. But that's not the case either. So you want to make sure that you still have people who care about service-oriented architecture principles, people who invest in a registry if I'm using SOA software like my company does. You know, governance and good practices are still important. It just might not be the project's responsibility to set all that up. So, you know, why BizTalk? Why SOA? If you look at what the key pieces of a service are, it's the contract, it's what are the interactions my service is exposing, it's the data, the messages going back and forth, It's obviously the logic of the service, clearly, and then the provider, who's hosting my service. So, I mean, if you think about that, clearly BizTalk can do all of those. I can define messages, I can define endpoints and what data goes back and forth, I can host my services in BizTalk, and I can put implementation, orchestration, routing rules, mapping. So BizTalk fits nicely into all the things that you expect from a service. But at its core, I mean, BizTalk's not just a service hosting engine, and clearly if we pitch it as that, we won't be successful. So, I mean, BizTalk's a broker. It intercepts messages and does things like data enrichment. So I send in a piece of something, and I rely on BizTalk to go get the rest of the pieces and fill it all up and ship it off to my last system. Protocol bridging, which is, again, some of the underrated stuff, is I can take something in from a file adapter and call an Oracle database. That stuff, you know, we've been doing it for a while now, but it's not trivial that I can take data in via all sorts of protocols and transition those to other ones on the way out. Security bridging, also something you don't, sometimes we take for granted that my downstream system might have no idea about the credentials of my caller, and I can make that work in a BizTalk environment. I can transition those security controls. That's a big aspect of what we're pitching with this. You know, something my company uses a lot is fanning out and fanning in. Where we are, SAP sends out key data. It goes just to BizTalk, so we don't have a lot of point-to-point to SAP, and BizTalk ships it off to dozens of downstream systems who care about employee records. You know, we hire or fire someone, goes from SAP to BizTalk, and goes to a dozen downstream systems who care. So some of your, you know, badge access keys and all sorts of things like that. So the fan-out pattern is a great example of leveraging that BizTalk bus to get things out. Same with fanning in. Got 10 systems that all want to tell me about a customer, and I've got one downstream system who needs to master all that data. I can fan into one endpoint and push it somewhere else as well. Clearly, things like service orchestration, a huge aspect of coordinating all these existing services in my SOA environment. How do I tie them all together, build new services, things like that. And endpoint management, it's definitely, you know, again, could be underrated that instead of having all these different places where I'm sending messages and trying to figure out where they are, I have one place where I can look and see where is data coming in and where is data going out. Now, at the same time, I think as we've all probably learned at some point or another, BizTalk does not solve all the problems, and when you shoehorn it into bad situations, you get more midnight calls because things don't work. So the key is that, you know, when is the broker not necessary? You know, let's say I have a SharePoint application that needs to pull data from a Siebel system, and it's a request reply. I can go through BizTalk for that, but if that's the sort of application where if that connection fails, the user's just going to refresh the browser. Why can't I just use this regular synchronous service that leverages the BizTalk adapter pack or something like that? I don't need the whole routing engine necessarily. I might not need reliable delivery and retries. I just have synchronous request reply where the caller is not sort of guaranteed. I just want to refresh and do it again. So it might be overkill, for example, to use a broker there. Or if I've got downstream systems that are really good with queuing and reliable delivery, you know, if I can publish a message to some great line of business system that if other things are down, it can queue messages. Again, I might not need to leverage a service bus. I can just have services that can call those endpoints and let them take care of the hard work. So again, the key is you don't grab BizTalk by default. You look at it, and as you look at the other tools coming out from Microsoft, whether it's the Dublin stuff or whether it's whenever the Oslo stuff comes out, and you've got, you know, SQL Service Broker, SSIS. There's a large set of things where I bet all of us could get a use case and solve the problem in 12 different ways using different Microsoft technologies. And then if you introduce other vendors, you have another 38 ways to do something. So it's important for us to not necessarily grab the thing that we're always just comfortable with and look at the use case. So some good practices. So, you know, spend the rest of the time in this first session looking at, if I'm exposing services or consuming services, what are a few best practices to do it in a service-oriented way? I'll throw in a couple demos just to keep you awake. So when we expose services, looking at the messages, a few tips for designing those in a service-oriented way. Abstraction is really important, which means looking at canonical schemas, not saying, you know, here's a really specific schema to my orchestration or to my downstream system, and I want to go expose that to the world. Take it up a level and look at what is the generic object I'm trying to define. Is it a customer? Is it an order? Is it a product? And not couple that to the downstream provider that may change over time. Right? If I swap out my CRM system and I store my customer somewhere else, do I want to replatform all of my internal plumbing because I kept tying it all to that system? Or do I want to have a set of very unique, you know, abstract schemas that define my core business entities, and they simply map to those formats right before they ship it to that system? So never, if you can help it, actually no, never period, take an adapter-generated schema and just expose that as your contract. For example, if I pointed a line of business adapter and expose a Siebel schema, that should never be your public-facing service contract. It's a Siebel schema. Those things are horrific. So the last thing I want is for someone to look at that and say, wow, this is my contract into BizDoc. BizDoc is terrible. So, you know, it's a good customer service thing to use abstract schemas. And, you know, the nice thing about schemas that a lot of people don't use is the reuse factor, is that I can define a core attribute like address, which typically is the same across all of your business objects. I can define one address schema in BizTalk, and I can inherit that in all my subsequent ones. So if you call me later and say, you know what, we have three lines for address, and we keep having people who live in strange places and need a fourth line, I could add a fourth line to the address schema, and everybody else gets that. So, you know, looking for canonical things doesn't mean the big business entity. It might be things like organization structure or addresses or some of these smaller chunks that I can build up together. Looking at XSC data types and things is, if you want to build schemas in a service-oriented way, don't think about just your initial subscriber to this. So .NET provider might have different data types than what a Java consumer can do. You know, things like XSD date time. People process date times completely differently. Maybe I want strings as my date time instead of that XSD value because that's very restrictive. Or, you know, floats in Java are treated differently than floats in .NET. So maybe I use a more generic decimal or an integer number instead. So thinking about not just your system, but maybe other subscribers, you design your schema in a little bit more cross-platform friendly way. So adding extensibility point is something interesting. I messed around with this in my book, which is, let's say you do have something like an address, and there's aspects of that that might change seasonally or change based on provider. And instead of doing two, you have two options there. Either I build the schema to accommodate everybody, and those never accommodate anyone because they end up being terrible for everybody, or you end up changing it all the time, which, of course, that's terrible too. You have to try to keep that in sync. So what you can do is, instead of those sort of options, add a more generic node in there that lets you put any XML structure, for example, in there, so that you can put system-specific XML into that schema without having to rebuild it for every additional consumer. So extending those schemas, adding those sort of flexible XSD any nodes strategically in some of the schemas is a nice way to future-proof particularly volatile parts of your schema. Now, of course, the lazy solution is to have a root node and an XSD any underneath it and say, hey, there we go. This will handle everything. And it will also be ridiculous to do that. So, you know, you use those sort of things strategically. If you have something that is going to be volatile over time and your choice is either version my schema every week or build in something that lets it change a little bit flexibly, then you pick those spots. Transition nice into versioning. So, you know, the default namespace that BizTalk puts on a schema, you should arguably never keep that because every single schema by default will have a different namespace. So if you like a nice strategy, you pick your namespace up front, you put that across your schemas, and then you decide as an organization, as a project, how you want to version that. Do you want to do V1, V2 in the namespace? Do you want to put a date time? My company tries to do that because sometimes you have important dates, like the date that's on some of our SAP schemas, we all know that was the day we went live. So when we change that date, you know, that's another strategic date in the organization. So meaningful namespaces, you know, reusing them across your projects, that's going to be a lot easier to maintain long term instead of having different namespaces for every single schema. So if we look at the endpoint and we're exposing services, contract first. Microsoft developers typically are not contract-first people because you had ASP.NET web services where I could just throw a web method on a function and congratulations, I have a service. It's not the typical model a lot of other developers in other technologies do, which is open up a WSDL, crank that bad boy out, and then start with that. You know, Microsoft developers typically started with code. It was convenient. So switching to contract-first is not a natural thing, at least it wasn't for me when I started doing it, but it's a nice way to define your interface and define your messages, be able to give that to your consumer now, who can now stub it out and build their project, and then you can go ahead and put in your implementation later. So let's look at how to do this in the latest version of BizDoc. All right. So what I did in my BizTalk project is I have a customer schema. And I'll zoom in on this in just a second. And so this customer schema lets me define core data attributes of customer for my organization. Doesn't matter the source or destination, this is what I want to call customer. So I've defined my schema first, which is a key part of contract first, is what are my messages, what does that look like. Now, typical, I'll use myself so I don't project on you. So when I would usually get this, my next step would be, all right, let's start building my orchestration, let's start building my solution, then maybe I'll walk through a wizard and generate my endpoint. The nicer way to do that, at least to some of your consumers, is to switch to, not back to the slide deck, is I went ahead and wrote a WSDL file, yes, by hand, because Microsoft tooling for writing WSDLs is still atrocious, but what can you do? I guess buy something else, but for me, I decided to open up Notepad and crank out a WSDL. So what I did here is instead of reproducing my schema, which could be tempting, I'm simply importing my schema. I just took a copy of that schema, threw it on my web server, and I can reference that. And I can reference the various messages going back and forth. And now I've defined the BizTalk endpoint to my upstream consumer. I can give them this WSDL. I can say, here you go. I haven't built anything in BizTalk yet except for a schema, but they can go ahead and do their job. Now, of course, you can say, well, that's great, but how do I actually put this into a BizTalk environment for it to use? So what I can do is take that. Ooh, stop doing that. With the new WCF adapters, I have actually a lot of control of using that WSDL as my BizTalk contract. So if I use a WCF custom, what I'm actually doing here is, you'll notice I'm using WCF custom, but I'm using an HTTP endpoint. So now BizTalk's actually acting as a web service provider. It's a host. It's actually going to establish that HTTP endpoint, and when I hit it in my browser, it doesn't matter. It's not IIS, obviously. BizTalk's actually the host for this service. And what I've done is you can add, the new adapters are actually pretty well thought out, as I can go ahead and add a behavior for service metadata. And I can go ahead and point to the WSDL that I have out on my web server. And now this becomes the service contract for this endpoint. So this would be instead of walking through one of those wizards, the web service publishing wizard or WCF service wizard, and exposing your orchestration as a service or exposing your schemas as a service. I've bypassed all that and decided instead I'm going to build my own service endpoint and I'm going to choose my contract. I'm not going to get the comically long names that exposing an orchestration as a service does. I hate that wizard. It makes the longest names I've ever seen. I think there's punctuation halfway through because they're so long. So I'd rather define my own contract and put it out there and be able to control the message shapes and operations. Now, to prove that actually works, if I take my URL that I'm using here, and put that into the browser, oh, you know that was going to happen, didn't you? That would probably be because, let's see, is my port actually started? No, that would help. First demo of the day, going rotten. I am in great shape for tonight. All right, so I start my port, which is the downside of then hosting it in BizTalk, because now I'm at the mercy of receive locations being turned on, hosts being turned on. I don't get the same IIS capability for hosting services. So, hey, look at that. So now when I hit my BizTalk endpoint, if you'll notice, the WSDL is not something random hosted from my service. It's actually pointing at the WSDL I created before, because it's using that metadata behavior to point to my WSDL. So the rest of the solution that I built was building a little console application, of course, that references this service, calls this service, And then in my BizTalk environment, all I have is another send port that subscribes on that receive location. So my BizTalk solution consists of that first schema, a receive location and a send port, and now this contract. Yeah?
So this bypasses IIS entirely.
Sure.
Yeah, so there's no, no virtual directories on anything.
Yeah, so this bypasses IIS completely. There's no virtual directories. There's none of that.
Is that really a good thing? I'm trying to get to, is that really a good thing? Because IIS adds a lot of other stuff like security and load balancing and blah, 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 blah. And now all of a sudden you have BizTalk being a web server. I see.
Yeah, for demonstrations, potential, it's excellent. For real life.
And tears.
Yeah, so clearly you've got a trade-off. Now I could still put load balancing. I could put a load balancer in front of this that points at, I could figure out some of those things. It might not be clean, and arguably this is not a great pattern for doing some of those things. Now, the nice thing is, if I did host this service in IIS, I can still use that metadata, external metadata location behavior, and even my IIS-hosted service can point at a different WSDL. So I don't have to host this in IIS in BizTalk to get that capability. I just took the lazy way because it takes too much time to deploy to IIS. But great question.
I personally would use the IIS thing and just point right in BizTalk because, well, BizTalk is usually clustered as well, and you have problems with putting a load balancer in front of a clustered BizTalk. Mm. So.
Yeah, no, good point. So your mileage may vary on trying to actually do this in real life. So I've started a send port which simply subscribes on the customer data. I'm not even cheating and doing subscribe on the receive port like we all do, at least on the first test. I'm subscribing on the actual message type just to prove it comes in and routes it around. So to prove that nothing's up my sleeve on the first demo, you'll see that this folder is indeed empty. So I have a little console app which again uses a minuscule font. Sitting in the front. Thank you for pointing out the obvious. So it's calling the contract first service. And the service call is complete. If I look on disk, sure enough, I have a message. So again, without deploying anything to IIS, deploying one thing in BizTalk, a schema, not having to walk through wizards, I can deploy web endpoints and get them in and have a very non-Microsoft friendly way, which is WSDL first, and have that play with everything else nicely. First demo works. You guys are in good shape now. So the second aspect of this is thinking about your message exchange pattern. I would argue that most of us are very, very comfortable with synchronous invocation of a service, right? I mean, I know if it comes back. I know if it didn't come back, I can catch exceptions. Asynchronous programming is dangerous and scary. You know, I'm throwing it off into the ether. I'm praying that it makes it there. What's my quality of service? But you know, the asynchronous message exchange pattern is a powerful one, right? Now I can pummel an endpoint and allow, in this case, something like BizTalk to just try to throttle that load without having to do all the logic right away. So I'm not trying to send acknowledgments back and queuing things up. Being able to just asynchronously send them off is great stuff. So, you know, thinking about that as an option, instead of just always doing that request reply pattern and using the BizTalk bus for publish subscribe is something you should look at. Now, if I do need the response back, because sometimes I want to kick off something asynchronously because I know it's going to take a day to reply, but I still want that callback later, or even it's going to take 5 minutes, and trying to tune IIS to, say, have a five-minute timeout on web services does not scale well. You know, trying to put that kind of logic in your web server. So the callback pattern, if you've done this in WCF, you can actually define a callback, and when the service is done, it'll punch it back to the client and update it on the fly asynchronously. So it does that by when WCF sends the message out, it actually creates a temporary hosted service on that client, and then the address of that service is in the message and it finds its way back. So WCF has great support for this. By default, BizTalk doesn't because it doesn't support or doesn't show support for that binding in WCF that lets you do this. Ah, but you can of course hack things away and make things work great. So it actually is not that hard to use callbacks in BizTalk that exploit that full WCF experience. So take a quick look at that. Okay. So what I have here is I've got two schemas. begging to be opened. I've got an order and an ignore order acknowledgement. So, I mean, you think about it, there's a lot of scenarios where you get that first piece of data in, and that user is going to want an acknowledgement inevitably because it's a tracking code on a package, or it's a request for something and you need to do a little research on the back end, but not a lot. So, again, you want to fire it off asynchronously, but you want to send something back. In this case, I'm going to give that user an acknowledgement back at some point that says, here's your tracking number, so you can plug it into the website and see when we're going to ship it to you. On the orchestration side, I build this like I might build any request reply orchestration. I take in an order, mess around with it and transform it, I wait a while, and then I go ahead and ship it back. So nothing in this, of course, is indicative of the fact that we're going to do this sort of asynchronous callback stuff. You don't have to, that doesn't have to bleed into your solution to make this work, which is a key aspect. Now, you can also mess around with this and not even use a request reply port. You could actually use one receive and one send and still make this work as well. So once I have this and I deploy this and all that sort of thing, I can go into BizTalk and use the dual HTTP binding, which is the WCF binding that supports callbacks. So what happens when I use this binding on both ends is that that extra channel is opened up on my client, and BizTalk now knows how to publish this back to the client. So you think, hey, that's pretty great stuff, I'm done. Hard part is that when you define your service contract to play with this, you have to define that callback contract, you have to define some attributes. And in the BizTalk world, I don't have the capability to do that. So now you feel like you're stuck again, I just teased you with something that you can't do and you're ready to leave. No, please wait. So what we can do on the client side is instead of adding that service contract by pointing at the WSDL file, which isn't going to be able to give me what I want because my WSDL isn't going to have all that fun duplex stuff, I can actually, in a separate assembly or in my client in real life, simply define a contract that represents my duplex communication. Now, if you happen to have eagle eyes, you might have noticed I also have schemas for the order and the order acknowledgement here. So what I did was pass these through, I think either service util or xsd.exe, took my schema and turned them into .NET classes so they would properly serialize across the wire. So far, no custom code, just ran my schema so I could get .NET classes. Then in my actual service contract, I specifically create a duplex friendly, oh, that's too far down. Poor guys in the bleachers are craning their neck. I define the callback contract. These are the key attributes for doing duplex, is I have to say, what in the world am I going to be shipping back to you? And then specifically using session, because I got to keep a connection open. So these were the key things I can't define in BizTalk to my knowledge yet. I can't figure out how to do that. So I went ahead and figured that I would just define this contract and BizTalk would know how to play with this because it can do the duplex binding underneath. It just can't set up this sort of infrastructure for the caller. So I did this. I don't want to open help. And yeah, so let's go ahead and I've got my receive location disabled. Now let's enable it. And I have no send ports because obviously it's coming right back to the caller. But I do have that orchestration that I want to start up. So now I've got the BizTalk side. The only thing that references this callback stuff is the dual binding on the receive location. Nothing in my orchestration, nothing in my schemas. And let's close that. And so what I want is I promise I'll get out of console apps at some point soon. But what I have is my duplex client, which again, I had that contract I wrote myself. And so it's going to call the duplex service. It's going to get into BizTalk. It's going to run. It's going to wait its allotted amount of time to account for all the different stuff you might be doing in your back office before you send the response back. It's processing more stuff. It's doing more really interesting things here. And then after that, asynchronously, that message is going to come back in, raise an event in my code, and do whatever is supposed to happen when that acknowledgement returns. you know, print a message, send an email, tell the user, oh, good Lord, that happened. Yes. So I got my order confirmation back asynchronously. So I kicked it off. Some other stuff was happening in my UI. An event was raised when that message came back. And now I did get my acknowledgement. So I used an async pattern, and I sent it off completely asynchronously, but I could still get that response back. So just don't treat async programming as I have to throw it all over the wall and never get something back. That's not necessarily true.
But you still have open connections between the client and the server, right?
At least for the duration of this. So now that this is closed, that session is going to be closed as well.
Yeah.
That's a good question. Of course, you're all strangers, so I'm not going to tell any of them as bad questions. That was an atrocious question. How could you? Okay, so the last aspect of this then is taking, you know, when you're thinking cross-platform, which, you know, interoperability is a key aspect of SOA, don't just latch on to a single adapter as your endpoint. One of the nice things about BizTalk and receive locations in that model is I don't have to just commit to one. I can take in basic HTTP. I can also do a file drop for that legacy system that can't talk HTML. So often think about, maybe not even up front, but you know, don't build in adapter-specific stuff into some of your logic if you can help it. Be flexible. So if you do start with HTTP to HTTP, and later someone has to send it to you via queue or via the file adapter or via email, you're just attaching more receive locations and exposing your service, if you will, via multiple channels. Don't be careful with these wizards that generate endpoints, just because if you already can't tell, wizards are usually bad. They just make you feel good up front. Sometimes they're fine, but you just end up with very unwieldy contracts. You get a ton of stuff in the headers for all the different policies, and it's just nicer to have a little more control over that sometimes. I have not come up with a reason yet, I think, that you really need to use the expose orchestration as a service. You can at least throw me a bone and do the expose schemas as web service, where you have control over what you call your operation, you know, what your messages are. The expose orchestration one is, that's the one that gives you the comically large WSDL file, and people who consume that have all kinds of line breaks just to even call your service. The same piece, an example of this is, what's neat about the BizTalk adapter pack, if you haven't played with it, is that it comes with, of course, a wizard to let you point at some of those endpoints, like the Siebel adapter or SQL or Oracle. And it, you can walk through, and it will build an HTTP proxy version of that adapter. So if I have an SAP system and I want to call a particular RFC, I can walk through the wizard, and it'll give me an HTTP endpoint that then invokes that. No code, just does that. Of course, what it does is it exposes an SAP schema and contract, and that's a mess. So it's a great feature that you should never use. When exposing logic, I think one of the key aspects when we're thinking about SOA and service-oriented architecture is your service logic, especially as the service bus, does not have to be orchestration. You know, orchestration's great. There's a performance overhead. Sometimes it's unnecessary. If I just take a message in and transform it and ship it back out, that is a real waste of processing power. I don't need to do that. So if I can use maps and subscription filters and pipelines, and again, not putting too much into things like pipelines and making it unwieldy, but you know, look for how can I just agilely move things around the message bus, use the broker and use the pub sub model without having to inject all these orchestrations all over the place. You can make your logic a little leaner. So if you do want to do orchestration in a service-oriented way, a couple of tips. Direct binding is your friend if you can. You know, starting an orchestration with direct binding means I can reuse it now, because it's not bound to a specific receive port. So if I want to take in customer and I don't care where it comes from, let me just direct bind on that customer canonical schema. Why should I have to couple it to how it comes in if it's got a multi-purpose function? You know, anybody who has an orchestration that requires me to zoom out to 3% and scroll for 3 pages built a really large orchestration that's never going to be maintained. We've all seen or created the horrific orchestration that, you know, you have to get coffee halfway through as you're trying to follow branches because it's enormous. That's really tough to keep up with. So as you look for ways to decompose that and say, you know, here's a function I might actually use somewhere else, or let me chain these together in a more of a workflow process where this orchestration's called, then this one, then this one. And if I need to add or remove steps, now I can. without trying to massively deploy this one orchestration. So you can think of orchestrations themselves as services. Right? Each thing might do a function that I can compose and reuse in other processes. Alignment of responsibility, that's something my boss constantly harps on me, is, you know, when you ask yourself about how something, where you're putting logic, your first question should be, does it belong here? Is it the responsibility of this thing to do that? Or does it belong in the source system, or in the destination system, or in a map, or in a pipeline? So, again, sometimes get outside your defaults and think, what is the most responsible place? Like, yes, this is totally mapping logic. It belongs in a map, not in a bunch of XPath statements in an orchestration. Or maybe it does, but, you know, ask yourself, where is the, who should own this capability, and spread that out across, you know, a map or a port or an orchestration. Yeah, things like validation are a good example. There's sometimes where you want to validate a message in a pipeline. Sometimes it actually does make sense to do it in orchestration, but, you know, don't always rely on one or the other. Yes, exposing services is fun in BizTalk. Consuming services. So as you would expect, a lot of these are pretty much the same. So, you know, when I want to consume a service, things like abstraction and loose coupling, clearly they still apply. So canonical schemas. Even if you're only consuming a service, I would argue you might not want to use that schema within your orchestration, because now if the provider changes their interface, if you switch out providers completely, now you've got to redeploy that orchestration code, change some of your logic. If you define a common product schema and you use nothing but that in your orchestration, you simply map it at the endpoints to all the provider and consumer specific formats, right? So if I swap providers, I add a new one, I haven't changed any of my core logic. I've simply changed mappings at the endpoints. I can do this with the SQL adapters and things like that. Is why put a SQL adapter schema in my orchestration? You know, I can map it at the endpoint, and if that schema changes, I don't have to redeploy a bunch of bits at once. Yeah, so SendPort mapping and pipeline. You know, as you want to be able to have system A, system B, system D in a C or D in a fan-out strategy, you know, why try to push all of that logic into the middle? All of that sort of mapping logic, you know, zipping logic, all that specific stuff, keep shoving that to the edges as much as possible, and you'll find out you're doing things in a much more service-oriented way by letting, you know, endpoints do their thing, let the middle do their thing, and stop bleeding it across the lines. So things like dynamic ports are kind of a neat way to not have to do a lot of tight binding to endpoints and allow you to be flexible as to how you use it. You know, runtime resolution, where I look up the endpoint at runtime and use that, very flexible way to swap where I'm pointing to without redeploying all my code or things like that. So if you've seen it, the ESP toolkit is pretty friendly with this, with at least dynamic resolution, and it uses dynamic ports all over the place, so that you have a limited number of ports now, and you allow the routing logic and to be maintained elsewhere. So if I have 30 subscribers for a customer message, I can either have 30 send ports that all look virtually identical, or I can have a single dynamic port that simply alternates with the addresses, and I maintain that address list somewhere else. So sometimes it's pick your poison. Maybe you consider the latter one also tough to maintain. But when you start getting a big environment, trying to maintain that many number of ports can be difficult. So using dynamic routing and things like that, I can limit how many things I have to maintain. So one of the things that, you know, when you're doing service-oriented architecture, specifically when you're consuming stuff, one of the more fun things to do, fun being extremely relative, is composing new services from the existing ones. So I've got a service that looks up a customer. I've got a service that then updates the customer. I have a service that then does something else to the customer. And I could choose to make my caller call all three services. That's a very fine-grained approach to the business. Now, for example, we use Siebel at work, and when you need to do things with customer records, there's typically look up the customer, do they exist, do something to them, do something else. It could be four service calls to do one thing. That's a very fine-grained, non-service-oriented way to go, if I were to expose that. Instead, I should build one coarse-grained service that says insert customer. And inside, it aggregates those other services and does a get and does an update and does something else. So if I can expose these coarse-grained services, I make it much easier to reuse that and hide some of that plumbing. And BizTalk's very good at service aggregation, as you would expect. Within an orchestration, I can in parallel, call multiple different services, but then expose one contract out of it. And I'll show you that in the afternoon session with cloud computing, where in my case, my orchestration calls two different cloud providers and an on-premises app, but exposes that via one service interface that someone calls. They have no idea that they went all over the place to get that data. Yeah, so I mean, there's a couple of great patterns in the ESP toolkit, things like scatter gather, where there's patterns already in there where I can send data in, have it go out to multiple different places, get its result set, and jam it all into one result. So again, I can request something, have it go off and do a bunch of work, consume a bunch of existing services, and then give me back one message instead of calling 10 services myself. So ESP itineraries are a capability in the ESP toolkit that let you almost model your message flow in a way that you really can't do with BizTalk today. So, I mean, you define what is the instruction. When data comes into BizTalk, what should I do with it? And you can say, well, I can kind of do that today, of course. I can build ports and orchestrations and maps, but you have no higher level view of that. You can't say, I'm literally tracing it through here and this is how it goes. An itinerary does let you define what that flow looks like. So, let's show you that. At least in a very quick fashion. So if we go back to my sleeping virtual machine. I wrote about the ESP guidance in my book, and naturally the week after it came out, the thing was changed to ESP toolkit, making me instantly less relevant. So lesson learned, don't ever write a book. So let's look at an itinerary I wrote for this, which simply shows how I want to do a messaging scenario and do some transformation of a piece of data. And the itinerary itself will process faster than the time it takes to open an itinerary, which is a key feature. So what we've done here is you use some predefined shapes. Get back there. Things like itinerary service, which are kind of multi-purpose things that let you do routing or orchestration. On-ramps, off-ramps, which really equate to how do I get data into the bus, how does data leave the bus. The broker services were added at the last second, once again screwing me in my book because I didn't have a chance to put them in. But they are pretty neat, is that they let you put some routing logic in there. So I can say, if this context property, if it came from the file adapter, route it here. If it came from here, do it there. So it lets me put some basic decision logic into my itinerary. So what I have here is I have an on-ramp. If we look at some of the attributes of an on-ramp, you pick which application you're pointing to. You pick the name of a receive port. So you don't pick a receive location. That doesn't matter. You're just picking which port is starting this itinerary. Next, I have a mapper service, which tells me which map I want to execute. Now, how I look up that map is completely up to me. In this case, I cheated and used the static one, which lets me manually pick which map I want to use. It gives me a drop-down list, I pick which one I want, and I move on my merry way. That's not a great way to go, because if I want to change the map, I have to go change my itinerary. So what I can actually do is use a number of out-of-the-box resolvers, as they're called, for things like looking it up in the business rules engine, or looking it up in UDDI, or maybe it's buried in the message itself and I want to point in the next path statement and say this is where you'll find the transform. So message is completely self-contained, tells you what to do with itself, and you can just look at those values and route it. That's a pretty interesting pattern for really dynamic environments. So the business rules engine is probably the one you'd most come across, which is, based on a bunch of criteria about the message or about its context, this is which map to use. So think about it, I could have a single receive port, and instead of putting 87 maps into that thing and hoping that the right one gets picked, I can simply allow the itinerary to look up the right map, attach it, and I don't have to do anything in my BizTalk environment for that to happen. So the next one is the off-ramp service, which in this case, this extender is going to tell you where in the world do I want to ship this thing to? Where is the final destination? Because if you'll notice, the off-ramp itself, it will only point at dynamic ports. So I can't point it at an existing file adapter port, things like that. This thing embraces dynamic ports like no man's business. So what you need to do is use a dynamic port. It can't have much embedded in there. And when you do that, what you need to do is tell it where in the world to get its information from. So once again, in my case, to try to reduce my rate of failure, I did use a static resolver and hard-coded the file directory path of where I want to drop this thing. But again, I could use the business rules engine in a neat way to finally do rules-based subscriptions. So I could have a complicated rule that determines if I send it to here or I send it to there, something that's sorely missing in the existing filter capability of a send port, where I can do this equals this, this is greater than this, and that's about it. So any sort of logic and conditional relationships I can't do. I can do that now. I could have a complex rule which completely dictates routing. So when I do this, what's nice is, you know, if I wanted to test this resolver and find out if I liked it or not, if it did what it was supposed to do, I can test. Yeah, of course. So typically you can test the resolver, find out what happens. You know, and it'll execute. If you give it an inbound message, it'll tell you, like, this is what the map would look like, or this is what your choice would have been. So you can do some testing, unit testing of your itinerary while you're in here. When you're done, you can choose to export. And now you can export this to file, which is okay, I guess, if you want to attach it at the client side. So it creates an XML file that represents this itinerary. And when the client calls the service, they can say, hey, here's the itinerary you should follow. Go nuts. That's not bad, but do I want my clients dictating message direction? That, you know, they could get themselves in trouble, they could get me in trouble. So the other option is I can deploy this to a database. When I do it in the database model, what's pretty cool is that on my receive side, I can go ahead and say on the receive side, go ahead and look up the itinerary and attach it when it comes in. So my client has absolutely no idea they're using the itinerary processing. They're just calling a web service. And on my receive location, I use a specific pipeline that comes with the guidance. Now, as you'll notice, this doesn't even have to be HTTP now. I'm using a file pickup. So it doesn't have to be web services. It can be a service that's picked up via a queue or via a database or via any input channel. All I have to do is pick this pipeline. Once again, I'm going to look like a slacker because I keep using the cheating means. But I picked statically what the name of the itinerary in my database I want to use is. So this is okay for the single port. If I want to have one web endpoint that takes in all sorts of data and picks itineraries on the fly, I can once again use a business rules engine-based itinerary selector that says, sheesh, based on the message coming in, based on any of its context properties, now pick this certain itinerary. So you think about that, that's a really wild use case that I could have one receive location that literally dictates direction for dozens of different inbound messages. And on the fly, it's picking which route that message should follow. So, you know, this stuff looks great. You have to look at your environment and say, do I need this sort of dynamic flexibility? Can I simply just tie my ports together and get on my merry way? And that's perfectly fine. But if you have very flexible endpoints, if you want to do some higher level modeling of your services, the itinerary stuff can be kind of compelling. So let's prove this actually works. So I've got a send port that is the dynamic port that was referenced in my itinerary. The only filter that's on here is the ESP specific one. So it says, you know, is it request reply? Because I can do request reply itineraries that you model it coming in and you model it going back out. So I'm saying, no, that's not true. What's the name of the service? I pick the service that's the name of my itinerary in this case. Is it a messaging service? Is it an orchestration service? So I pick these four attributes on all of my dynamic endpoints. And when that itinerary processes and keeps incrementing to the next step, when it gets to that last step, it'll call this dynamic send port. So let's see if I'm lying or not. So I have an ESP folder where I'm going to pick up vendor A, ESP folder where I'm going to send that vendor's order back out. So the key was I'm doing mapping here. So again, I could have a process where all my different vendors come into one specific receive location. I map them all to my canonical message format and then still route it based on who they are. But I don't have to set up 38 receive locations and ports to accommodate all my different vendors. You all come in, I map you based on itineraries, and I have a lot less to manage. So if I grab an instance, have you ever seen a BizTalk demo that does not use the file adapter? Honestly. So we'll pick that up. Is that right now? Wow, that was fast. Ignore the time zones. It's 10 o'clock in the morning for me still. So it dropped off my customer, and it mapped it to my canonical format. And again, I could change my itinerary now. I don't have to change any of my BizTalk-related stuff. I could change which map I use. I could change the file name. I just have to publish this XML file back to the database. So itinerary processing is pretty neat. The ESB toolkit is pretty interesting. You can kind of pick and choose what you want to use out of it, and maybe you'll have a session at some point on that if you haven't already, but overall, it's good stuff. So really, the key of the consuming services is pretty much everything you think about doing on receiving services, you know, encapsulating your stuff, using, you know, encapsulating a receive port and putting maps and the right pipelines there, putting a wall around your orchestration and just doing business logic there, not doing a lot of routing rules or not doing a lot of tight coupling to endpoint-specific schemas. All those sort of things come into play both on the send and receive side. Now, if I'm exposing services, those are good practices. If I'm receiving them, they're good practices. Okay. Break time. And I'm on time. Look at me. So, yeah, it gives you hope for the second session that you will get to watch the game. So after the break, what I'm going to show you is how I can use the .NET Service Bus and use the Windows Azure to consume and expose services in the cloud from my on-premises Service Bus. And then I'm going to show you a ridiculously complicated demo of how I weave all this stuff together using the Google App Engine, Salesforce.com, Amazon, and Windows Azure. It actually kind of makes sense. These guys saw it earlier, and at least shows how you orchestrate cloud services in the future and hopefully gives you a leg up on that. So, there you go.